Some years back during the Obama administration, I spent a lot of time interviewing Secretary of State John Kerry for a profile that we published at the end of 2015. He was trying to talk down tensions between Israel and the Palestinians and to broker a peace in Syria. Kerry seemed to relish jobs that others might think absolutely impossible. He is considered relentless, I wrote in 2015, sometimes to a fault. There's no concealing his eagerness to make a deal. To a critic, his style is reminiscent of the customer who sternly tells the salesman, "I'm not leaving here until you sell me a car." But if peace in the Middle East certainly eluded Kerry, his current project seems a great deal harder still. Kerry is now serving as the Special Envoy for Climate, a cabinet-level post created by President Biden. Kerry needs to reverse our standing in the world on climate policy following 4 years of Trump's denialism. And the clock is ticking even louder as the effects of climate change become brutally apparent to us all over the world. I spoke with John Kerry last week. You were just in Europe to drum up support for climate action in advance of talks in October in Glasgow, which are essential. You've said that these are the last chance to keep temperature rises below 1.5 degrees Celsius. What is your sense of the state of the world on this, the sense of urgency? Because, you know, we're constantly getting warnings, this is the last chance, this is the last chance. And here we are in a summer of what seems to be apocalyptic conditions already.
Well, they are apocalyptic, and it's more serious than it's ever been at a time that it seems as if some key nations are just unwilling to do their part, to bite the bullet and step up. So let me put that in perspective. At the summit that President Biden hosted last April, we had about 40 nations there, but we had the 20 largest economies who happen to also be the largest emitters of CO2.
More or less the 20 largest.
Well, 55% of global GDP out of that meeting committed to try to hold the Earth's temperature to the 1.5 degrees. And 45%, therefore, did not. And that includes China, Russia, India, South Africa, Brazil, a host of countries. So we have to move those countries. And David, if we don't get them to buy into faster reductions from 2020 to 2030, 1.5 degrees is dead. You won't be able to achieve it.
1.5 degrees centigrade.
1.5 degrees centigrade limit on the rise of Earth's temperature. So I do view this personally, after a 30-year journey on this, I view this as the last best hope for the world to get serious and make the decisions necessary to try to reduce and hold the 1.5. And even 1.5, imagine what happens at 1.5 if you already see what's happening at 1.2. Is that what we want? You would think not.
Describe for me what it's like to talk to the Chinese on these issues. What is the dynamic? What is the back and forth that occurs? What is their rationale as you understand it?
I mean, China, for instance, is a contradiction because China has deployed more renewables than any other country in the world. But China has used an extraordinary amount of fossil fuel to get where it is in its economy. China's rationale is that they are doing a great deal, that they're doing more than most developing. They consider themselves a developing country still. And they posture that a developing country has a right at this point to be able to develop more. Our counter, obviously, is we want you to develop. We're fine with you developing, but you don't have to develop dirty. You don't have to develop by putting, you know, more coal-fired power plants online. And that's what's been happening in the last few years. China, regrettably, has continued to build coal-fired power plants and to fund them in other countries around the world.
To make the politics even more vexed, even more complicated, the U.S. has accused the Chinese government of genocide against the Uyghurs on a very large scale. How can you accuse someone of genocide, however grounded in reality, without doubt, and yet at the same time get them to cooperate with you on a political, a technological, ecological problem of such huge scale and importance?
Well, obviously, difficult. It takes a discipline to do it. But both President Biden and President Xi agreed in their initial conversations and in public statements that the climate crisis is so serious that they would separate it, that this would be a track on which hopefully we can compartmentalize and actually make progress. And historically, big nations with great power have been able to do that. Gorbachev and Reagan and Reykjavik decided we would stop pointing 50,000 warheads at each other and move to reduce those numbers way down to about 1,500. It happened, despite the fact that Reagan believed the Soviet Union was the evil empire. So in terms of international affairs and diplomacy, we on my team are taking both leaders at face value that this is a separate issue. It doesn't mean that every arm of the government is going to stop saying something about Uyghurs or human rights, but it does mean that we have the ability to be able to separate things and work where our common interests require us to work.
How costly was the behavior of the Trump administration regarding climate? What did it cost us in terms of time? What did it cost us in terms of every time you walk into a negotiating room with foreign partners?
The damage that President Trump wreaked worldwide, not limited to climate, but on climate, he did a whopper of a job of putting America's credibility in a terrible place, destroying it fundamentally. I hear from country after country, how do we know we can count on America? How do we know that, another president is going to come along or someone like Trump who does the same thing again? And my answer is very simple, that I don't believe any one politician can come along in the future and turn this tide, because all around the planet, private sector is moving rapidly to do what governments aren't doing. There's a major undertaking by banks, by asset managers, by corporations who are considering ESG in the boardrooms and who have made commitments to the Sustainable Development Goals. There are trillions of dollars now moving to invest in alternative renewable energy, whether it's solar, hydro. There's just a phenomenal amount of economic activity being generated. And I don't think any politician would want to turn it around, frankly, in a few years, but also I don't think they could.
Considering all the political context you've just provided, one of the difficulties here is it demands sacrifice of everyone to avert catastrophe. Transitioning to renewables is going to cost trillions of dollars and upend huge industries. We're likely to have to eat less meat, use more public transportation. All of this is necessary. To what degree are you and Joe Biden and your foreign counterparts really leveling with everybody, with whether it's each other or with all of us, all the way down to the lowest level?
David, I think we're being completely direct and totally transparent. And I don't agree with you that this is sacrifice. I don't agree with that. I do not believe people will have to necessarily eat differently. I mean, agriculture will change. There's a lot of research and work being done now on diet of cattle, for instance. And there's a thing called asparagosis, I believe that's the right name, which is a seaweed that has been very apparently in its early trials has reduced, if not eliminated, flatulence from cattle. And I'm confident that there will be huge research done that will change some of these things. And all of the economic analyses show that there are millions of jobs to be created. The United States, we need to build a legitimate grid. We can go to the moon. We can direct a rover on Mars. We can invent vaccines. But we can't send a simple electron from California to New York. So in the building of that smart grid in America, you will put electricians and plumbers and pipe fitters and steel workers and heavy equipment operators and countless disciplines to work. And there's so many exciting parts of this. I mean, cars will be electric, not internal combustion engine, but you're still going to have workers, United Auto Workers, producing those cars. And I just think we're looking at a remarkable transformation. This will be the biggest economic transformation since the Industrial Revolution, literally.
Secretary Kerry, if I go to Fox News, I see a lot of these efforts mocked as they're going to come and take away your hamburgers. If I turn to the Senate, you looked at the first of the Biden administration's big infrastructure bills, and it was supposed to contain all sorts of climate measures. And that got gutted from the bill when Senate Republicans opposed it. How do you sell bold climate policy to Republicans?
There are more and more Republicans, I think, David, who are really now beginning to take this more seriously and who are trying to figure out what actions they are prepared to support. And I understand even in the House of Representatives, I think there has been some movement among some. What I think is that Mother Nature is messaging pretty forcefully right now. Temperatures going up, the storms are getting more intense, the fires are bigger and more expansive and more frequent. So I think increasingly leaders are taking note of this and recognizing. For instance, President Putin was very clear. They have a real challenge in the northern part of Russia, in Siberia, in the tundra. The permafrost and the tundra are thawing. They have cities there where they're becoming unstable. They're deeply concerned about the methane that is being released after 40,000 years of containment in the earth. So Mother Nature is saying, is kind of screaming at people, hey guys, you know, you got a problem.
Mother Nature is screaming at them, but in Russia, for example, you have an economy that's based almost entirely, or to a huge measure, on an oil industry.
Correct. They are an extractive economy, and we've talked very directly about that with Russia. But they have an ability now, because they produce gas. Russia has an option of quickly closing coal plants that are more than 40 years old, inefficient, not working that effectively and not needed, in favor of transitioning to gas for the moment. And I emphasize for the moment, because gas is still a fossil fuel and gas is mostly methane. So it leaks and it also produces CO2. So it's not, in our judgment, anything near a long-term solution unless somebody discovers 100% abatement.
You're going from one meeting to the next, one country to the next, laying the groundwork for what we hope will be a successful climate negotiation in Glasgow come November. What would be the best possible outcome in Glasgow, and what are the forces mitigating against it?
The best outcome would be in Glasgow that the 20 major economies are all in agreement that they're going to make the best cuts they can, according to the science, between 2020 and 2030. We want people to lay out plans for how they will get to net zero by 2050. And finally, I think the key will be to have cemented in through the finance structure, the $100 billion, the Green Climate Fund, that there will be money there to make this a just transition. For people in parts of the world where they're taking the brunt of what is happening because of the developed world, and they can't afford to make the transition themselves and do what they need to do to contribute. The frustration here, David, is that we can meet this challenge, and we have the ability to be able to minimize the danger and help countries to adapt and build resilience, but there's no debate anymore about science. Anybody who is reading, listening, learning, knows this is actually happening now, and it's human beings who are adding the greatest amount of fuel to the fire.
Secretary Kerry, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
John Kerry, former Secretary of State, is the special presidential envoy for climate.